So, as I mentioned, we are in 2 Chronicles chapter 32. We've been talking about Hezekiah. Last week, we were still talking about him and his reign. We're going to continue that this week. Hopefully, we'll finish that up. Again, he reigned from about 726 B.C. to about 697. And then following Hezekiah is Manasseh. Manasseh would be followed by Amon, and Amon would be followed by Josiah. We'll see how far we get on that journey this evening. As we were talking about in our last study, let's go to 2 Chronicles 32, verse 1. Now, in our last two discussions, what we noted was the early reign of Hezekiah really stands out as a time of growth in the faith of the people. He was able to accomplish a lot of good things for God because of his faithfulness. And like kings we've seen in the past, their lives can almost be broken down into stages. And as we get into our study tonight, what you'll notice is some of the latter times in his life, he had some stumbling blocks that he had to overcome. Now, just a view here of our timeline. We're about 700 B.C. And you'll see how his reign overlaps with Hoshea. Hoshea reigned about 9 years before the northern kingdom was taken captive by the Assyrians, and we're about 100 years of the timeline before the Babylonians will come into the southern kingdom and will take them captive. And so we'll have more to say about that, but just trying to get these in line. Also, I want you to note this one doesn't do as good a job with the prophets, but who are the prophets of this day? Well, Isaiah is a big prophet. Micah is a big prophet. You know, to our family, that's pretty important, right? And then Hoshea was a prophet during this time. These are the writing prophets, not including, of course, there were some just oral prophets of the time. But just to kind of get a picture of what's going on. All right, so verse 1 says what? After these things, after what we've just read about, all these wonderful things that he did, and these acts of faithfulness. So real quickly, what were the things we highlighted that he did? All right, so one of the things they did was they cleared the land of idolatry. What was the very first thing he did? Anybody remember what it was? They cleansed the temple. You remember his father had shut the doors to the temple. Well, Hezekiah opened the doors up. That wasn't enough, right? I remember somebody telling me they went on a vacation one time and they'd rented a house. And you ever done that? And if you have, you realize that not all timeshares or not all time cabins or places you go to stay are created equal. And not all of them look like the pictures. And I remember somebody telling me one time they went to this one cabin, and when they walked in, woo, the smell coming out of that place. So what did they spend the first part of their vacation doing? Cleaning out a cabin so then they could use it the rest of the time. Well, sometimes things have to be cleaned out. You may go into your child's room, and sometimes, you ever been hit by that whiff? We have dear close family that I remember their son's very active in sports, and sometimes where he puts his sporting gear, it's not the best smell, right? But that's kind of what the temple was like. It had been so corrupted. So he goes in and cleans out the temple. That's number one. What's the second thing he does? He what? He got rid of the idols. Well, that comes just a little bit later. But you're close. It's all there together. But the second thing he does is he reestablishes the calendar, right? They go back to celebrating the Passover. He also, in all of that, reestablishes this, He, in essence, cleanses the priesthood. He reestablishes the order of the priest. He has them re-sanctify themselves, re-cleanse themselves. Out of all of that, they then go and attack all these idols. And they clear the land. I mean, and it's not like former kings. He goes to and he cleanses the land. Not just of the Baal worship, not just of the idols around the temple, because you remember his father had put idols in the temple and around it. He took care of all of them. But he even went up to the high places. I mean, that's a big problem. Asa, Jehoshaphat, they were good kings, but they didn't get rid of the high places. And that was caused them problems. Well, Hezekiah gets rid of all of that. And I think it's pretty important. So that it was in those all of those things he's doing that verse 30, chapter 32, verse 1 is talking about. After those acts of faithfulness, Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, came and invaded Judah and encamped against the fortified cities, thinking to win them for himself. It's a very interesting text here. Now, Hezekiah's done a lot of good things, right? How do you think he feels about this? What's going on here? I mean, could he possibly be thinking, God, why is this going on? What the text tells us is he invades the land and he takes every one of the cities around Jerusalem. Sennacherib, in his own writings later on, we found this out through archaeology and discoveries. In writing about this, Sennacherib says that that he was able to take 46 cities in Judah. Now, if you're King Hezekiah and you're kind of shut up in Jerusalem, what might you be thinking? Sorry, I got a tickle in my throat. Why does this happen to me? Didn't I just do all this stuff for you, God? Why is God allowing this to go on? There's another time it says he tests him after he takes care of Sennacherib. There's another event where the text tells us God was testing him when the Babylonians come. We'll get there in just a little bit, but you're right. I think this may be another test of God. But Sennacherib, what has he just done? Yeah, and lots of other places. Now, what we've already mentioned is that the Assyrians and the Babylonians are brutal. When they come in, they destroy, and they are brutal invaders. And so they come down into the land, and so now this becomes a test for King Hezekiah.
Josephus, the writings of Josephus, you know, he portrays they didn't take Jerusalem, but they went and took some of the other cities, and Lachish was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And the brutality, you know, that impaled the men and boys and marched the rest of their family by. And then anybody that was, let's say, if they were in an office of control, they filleted them alive. I mean, it was just horrible. But, you know, but they didn't lay a hand on Hezekiah, even though they didn't even put up a siege wall, you know, and they didn't. But 185,000 of their men died, you know.
Yeah, and it's interesting. You have to kind of get that picture to understand where Hezekiah is. Now, he's going to make some mistakes here. We're going to talk about those in just a minute. But I think to be fair to him, we at least need to understand what he's up against. Now, does it justify what he did? No. but at least it helps us to understand. And I think it actually shows him as being a man just like David. When he does something wrong, what does he do? He will eventually turn back to God. And that's ultimately what he does. And so that's what he's facing. I wish I had I should have put a map up here, but I didn't do that. But just they have surrounded Jerusalem. Now, Jerusalem, of course, is at almost the northernmost part of Judah. So it's just across the border. So they've come around it, taken all these cities here. And numbers-wise, we're going to get a picture of that in just a minute, at what they're facing. And it's an obstacle seen from human eyes. Now, what Hezekiah is challenged with is not to see it from man's eyes, as other kings have done, but to see it from the perspective of God is on my side. And I can overcome this because God's on my side. So let's talk about some of what he does. So the first thing, you're a king, what are you going to do? You need to put up some fortifications. Verses 2 through 4 tell us a little bit about what he began to do. It says, when he saw Sennacherib had come and intended to fight against Jerusalem, he planned with his officers and his mighty men to stop the water of the springs that were outside the city. And they helped him. Now, why would he want to stop up the springs? Obviously, I want to note that he knows they're coming. He has some amount of time to implement this plan. So he wants to stop up the springs. Why? What's that?
You gotta have water for people and their
cattle. Yeah. And he's like, why should we provide the water so that they can just come and hang out here for a long period of time with the water they need? And so he decides we need to stop up those springs so that it's not going to be so easy for them. And so he does that. Verse 5, he set to work resolutely and built up all the wall that was broken down and raised towers upon it. And outside he built another wall. He strengthened the Milo in the city of David. He also made weapons and shields in abundance. So again, what's the unsaid thing here?
He's preparing for battle.
He's preparing for battle. Also, he's got some time. He knows this is coming. He's seen it well in advance. This didn't happen overnight. He doesn't just look out the window one morning and, oh, there's Sennacherib across the way. He's coming to get me. So he has some time. So it says that he begins to repair the wall. For whatever reason, the wall has some disrepair in it. So he comes back. He has enough time to repair those patches. He then does what? Builds another wall outside of that. This is going to take some time, right? I'm just trying to think about, you think about the time this is going to take. Now, what he doesn't tell us, and from my understanding, I don't know what it was he used to make the wall. I don't know. I don't imagine this is like a concrete block wall, but maybe it is. It seems like that would take a lot longer to build. But he completes some kind of structured wall around a second wall. Pretty common practice in cities of the day. You think about Jericho. When they come to Jericho, what does the Bible tell us? How is Jericho constructed? Very similarly, right? They have these humongous walls. Jericho, I believe the construction of the wall, each layer was about 6 feet. That's a big wall. And so they have a similar construction around Jerusalem there to protect against this onslaught. So, going down to verse 6, he also notes he's making weapons and shields. Verse 6 tells us he set up combat commanders over the people. So he begins to put his army in order and develops a battle plan. Now, what does the end of verse 7 say? The people took confidence from the words of Hezekiah. This is going to be important. He has the faith of the soldiers. Now, we're going to see in just a minute why that's significant. They believe in him, and I think it has a lot to do with what happened earlier, right? What he did faithfully has now paying off in his soldiers' confidence in him as a war general. And we're going to see why as we move forward. So he begins to prepare for battle, and then Sennacherib invades Judah. Verse 13, in the 14th year of Hezekiah, so 14 years Hezekiah has been king. How long has it been since he took the northern kingdom? Been just a few years. It's not been that long. Now you remember that it took Assyria 3 years to take the northern kingdom, and now we're a few years beyond that, that Sennacherib has now decided, well, now I'm going to go take Judah. And so it's in the 14th year of 29 years that Hezekiah is going to reign. Now it's interesting that Hezekiah reigns 29 years because at the end of his life, how much time does he have added? 15, which you divide that out, he's kind of right on that line, isn't he? If he doesn't get that extension of life. But we'll note that in a little while. So they're prepared for battle. 14th year, the king of Assyria, Sennacherib, comes up against all the fortified cities. Hezekiah, king of Judah, sent to the king of Assyria at Lachish. Now, we just mentioned Lachish. That's where the king of Assyria is stationed. I don't know if I have Lachish on this map. I don't see it. But anyway, he's at the city of Lachish. That's where he's in battle. Now, I said, as I mentioned before, Hezekiah, not everything he did was good, right? He's facing a difficult situation, and unfortunately, he gives in to temptation. Here are a couple different ways. We're going to notice the first way here in verse 14. What's the first thing he does? Sorry. What's the first thing he doesn't do? No, I think he doesn't consult God. I think it's his first mistake. Where does he go first? What does he try to do first? Verse 14. Excuse me, I'm sorry. He does what?
Ask about the gods of the other nations.
Well, he tries to compromise, doesn't he? He tries to go to compromise. He tries to pay off the king of Assyria. Now, God had made a promise to all the kings of Israel, all the kings of Judah. What was it? If you're faithful to me, I will fight for you. Now, he doesn't go to God here. And I think it's his first big mistake.
32:14?
Yeah. You know what? I'm giving you the wrong chapter. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
My bad. 2 Kings 18. My fault.
2 Kings. Okay.
Verse 14. I'm sorry. That's my fault. Thank y'all for correcting me on that.
Yeah.
2 Kings 18. 14. It'd be good if I give you the right reference.
Well, it's up there on the screen.
18. Yeah, I'm disagreeing with my own screen, aren't I? So he tries to compromise and to buy off the king of Assyria. Now, what's the king's response, Sennacherib's response?
Verse
Well, he says, verse 14, I've done wrong. Now, had he done wrong? Had he done anything wrong? No. Yet he's just trying to pay off this mobster who's coming into his land and invading his land because he's a power-hungry, evil dictator. But out of fear, he says, whatever you impose, I'll bear. The king of Assyria required of Hezekiah, king of Judah, 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold. And Hezekiah gave him all the silver. It's not fun to watch somebody lose faith. What was the very first thing King Hezekiah did? What was the very first thing he did? And a good thing. He restored the temple. What is he doing right here? He's desecrating the temple. He turns around, and because of fear, he then desecrates the very thing that God praised him for. Now, is King Hezekiah still proved to be a faithful man of God? Yes. But it still gives us no joy to read about someone losing faith. It says that he gave him all the silver that was found in the house of the Lord and in the treasuries of the king's house. At that time, Hezekiah, verse 16, stripped the gold from the doors of the temple of the Lord and from the doorpost that Hezekiah, king of Judah, had overlaid and gave it to the king of Syria. Here's the thing, I think an important principle for us. Compromise with sin will tear down the good things that God does through us. Anytime we compromise with sin, evil, false doctrine, we end up tearing down the thing that God has built through our own hands. We cannot compromise with sin. We cannot give in. When we give in, we destroy so much. And what you also notice here from this example is that when he did all of that, what did the king of Assyria still do? He still invaded. Because he knew he had him at that point. At least he thought he had him at that point. And if it hadn't been for God stepping in, he would have. When we begin to compromise with sin, with evil, it will not be satisfied by what we first offer it. It will always want more. That old proverb is so true, and I know it's kind of cliche-ish, but sin will take you where you don't want to go. It will keep you longer than you want to stay, and it will cost you more than you wanted to pay. And it does that every time. We can't give in to that temptation. We can't look for the easy way out. Hezekiah, I have some sympathy for him. Because you know what? I've been there. And you have too. Sometimes we don't see a way out. We don't see the way to avoid sin. And so we compromise with it. What God reminds us of, and I believe this is the real message of 1 Corinthians 10:13. We don't see the way out always. We don't see the way God's going to deliver us. He just promised He will. What's the emphasis on us is when we don't see a way out, it's just to trust Him to provide it. And not to give in to temptation. Because temptation will lie to us. It'll make us think, oh, it's okay, just this one time. And then that's what you hear the 10th time and the 20th time. Just one more time, it won't matter. It doesn't matter if you go every Sunday to worship. God's okay with that. That one more sip isn't going to kill anybody. That one more word is not going to hurt anybody. Who cares, right? Those are the lies of temptation. We cannot compromise. And that's a lesson, a very difficult lesson, that Hezekiah had to learn. And so he tries to compromise with sin. He tries to compromise with the king. Verse 17 tells us that the king of Assyria sent the Tartan, the Rabshakeh, with a great army. That's his response, right? He doesn't go away. He doesn't leave him alone. When did Satan leave Jesus alone? When does he leave him alone? After he withstood the temptation and didn't give in. The text says he left him for a while. What if Jesus had given in to one of those? Is he going anywhere? No. It's not the way he works. James says, if you draw near to God, I'll draw near to you. You draw near to Satan, he's going to take up residence. He's going to move on in. He's standing outside that door knocking with his bag in his hand. So he sends the great army there. He calls for the king, verse 18, and you have a couple guys come out. Eliakim, Shebna, and Joah, they all come to speak with the Rabshakeh. And the Rabshakeh has some words. He says, say to Hezekiah, thus says the great king, the king of Assyria, what do you rest this trust of yours? Do you think that mere words are strategy and power for war? In whom now do you trust that you have rebelled against me? Behold, you are trusting in Egypt, that broken reed of a staff. Ah, we've got the third problem of Hezekiah. What has he done? We noted that he didn't go to God. He tried to compromise. And then what else did he do? He went to Egypt for help. Egypt! Instead of going to God, his true help, he went to Egypt, that idolatrous Egypt, who even Assyria looked at and laughed. Egypt? Really? Some of us have struggles in life. Who do we go to for help? The lesson should be what? We go first to God. But then, what about after that? Does God give us other sources of help?
Yeah, the church.
The church. Yeah. Our brother, do we always go to their brothers and sisters?
No.
Sometimes we turn to people of the world to help with a spiritual problem. How does that make any sense whatsoever? I have a problem physically. I'm not going to go to the mechanic and ask the mechanic to figure out what's going on with my heart, am I? Does that sound ridiculous? It's because it is ridiculous, right? The mechanic ain't going to help me with my heart. Now, if my car has a problem, mechanic may be the very person I need to speak to. If I'm struggling spiritually, should I be going to people who are of the world? We're living in the world, like the world. What kind of advice are they going to give me? They're going to give me godly advice?
It's okay.
Don't worry about it.
God wouldn't want you to be unhappy.
Oh.
That's the fame of many in the world, right? When did God ever promise us happiness? It's the silliest thing I ever heard, right? But it's also silly to go to people who are lost seeking help on how to be set. Where do we turn when we need help? Turn.
We just talked about he tore down the gods and the idols, but he goes to an ally, or trying to make an ally of a country that that's what they believe in, you know, is worshiping false gods. So it's kind of
sick people going to sick people for help. Now, it's not that we in the church have it all figured out, but at least we're all trying on that same path, aren't we?
I think we at least got an instruction book, and the world doesn't acknowledge that.
They're not even traveling down this road, right? They're not even trying to go this way. They're over there somewhere. Hezekiah. Which
that I think is a problem we have to deal with is we try to maintain this picture of who we are, and we may not be that really, and we don't want people to find out. So I'd rather go talk to somebody else and let the brothers and sisters of the church find out what's really going on.
Which is that's brings up another issue for us in the church that we need to be invited to come to us when they need to. We hope that we give people reason to want to come to help from the church, that we don't push people away. But at the same time, when we need help, where are we seeking it from? And so it's both sides there. We've got to make sure we're doing what we're supposed to be doing, both as the one who's there to help and the one who is seeking help.
Relationships. We have to know one another to feel comfortable enough to share those things that we're struggling with.
That's why being a part of the church is more than coming to worship. You can't expect to be a part of a family when you only show up for the time when we're not fellowshipping. That's God's time. Let Him have that. And then afterwards is the church time, when we get to know each other. But if we cut ourselves off from the church, and then when we need help, who's going to be there, right? And that means we need to invite ourselves in to the group, and that means being actively involved. And those of us who are members need to be warm and inviting. So it's a big complicated thing, but not that complicated, just us doing it. So he goes to Egypt. So he made some mistakes here, and it's got him into trouble. Notice what the Rabshakeh continues to say. verse 22. Well, I'm going to note the end of verse 21 just real quickly, and I'll move on. Such is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to all who trust in him. He says he's a broken reed. And I think it's interesting, from a worldly standpoint, where did this worldly man see King Hezekiah putting his trust? In God? No. He's trusting in the Pharaoh. Is that a little bit of a problem of Hezekiah? What else has he done? He's harmed his influence, hasn't he? They don't see him as a man seeking after God in this moment. They see him as a man seeking after Egypt. When we seek for help outside the church, what does that do to our influence? Verse 22, but if you say to me, we trust in the Lord our God, is it not he whose high places and altars Hezekiah has removed, saying to Judah and Jerusalem, you shall worship before this altar in Jerusalem? Now, here you see the misunderstanding of the king of Assyria and his worldly understanding. How does he view the world? As a polytheistic one, right? His view of God is God's, all these gods, right? He doesn't understand who the real God is. And so for him, those high places were just as valuable as the altar in Jerusalem. And so you also see in all of this, you see his misunderstanding of who Jehovah God is. He goes on, come now, make a wager with my master, the king of Assyria. I will give you, now he's saying a little sarcastic, and you'll see that. Make a wager. Come now, make a wager with my master, the king of Assyria. I will give you 2,000 horses if you are able on your part to set riders on them. What's he saying? You don't even have 2,000 men. Now, I don't know how large the Assyrian army was, but my view is, or my understanding is much larger than that. Right, you're talking about thousands upon thousands of soldiers in the Assyrian army. And you're talking in Jerusalem, an army of less than 2,000 soldiers. So again, you get kind of the picture that's going on here between these two kings and what they're up against. And then he goes on... Verse 25, moreover, is it without the Lord that I've come up against this place to destroy it? What is he claiming? He's claiming he's doing the Lord's work. Not you, King Hezekiah, I'm doing it. And so he will go on to blaspheme God. That in itself is a blasphemy against God, is it not? And then in verse 26, Eliakim and the other men say to the Rabshakeh, please speak to your servants in Aramaic. Why? For we understand. Do not speak to us in the language of Judah in the hearing of the people who are on the wall. Why do they not want them to speak in Hebrew?
Keep them ignorant of what's going on.
Discourage the people.
They're worried that they hear this, then they're going to run away, right? They're going to give up. Now, remember what I said earlier about the faith of the men in Hezekiah. It's going to be real important. Let's go on. But the Rabshakeh understands what they're asking for. And so he says, has my master sent me to speak these words to your master and to you and not to the men sitting on the wall? He sees an opportunity, doesn't he? Who are doomed with you to eat their own dung and to drink their own urine? Not a pretty picture, right? If you could go into verse 28. Let's see. He says, let's go down to verse 31. The Rabshakeh speaking to the men on the wall. He says, do not listen to Hezekiah, for thus says the king of Assyria. Right? Do not listen to him. He says, make your peace with me and come out to me. And he's trying to get them to give up. I encourage you to go back and read all that, but I want you to get down here to the end. So he's saying that. He says, how's your God going to deliver you? He didn't deliver any of the other people, did he? Verses 33 and following. Verse 36, but the people were silent and answered him not a word, for the king's command was, do not answer him. The men stayed on the wall. They didn't run away. They didn't give in to their demands. The men stayed in their place. All this would be over had they given up. You know, what we don't often think about in these conflicts is the faith of the soldier. as much as the faith of Hezekiah is one, and his repentance and restoration with God are one to be esteemed, the faith of those soldiers on that wall that day, they could have gotten down, they could have given up. They don't do that. They see the same thing. They heard the same words. Let's don't discount their faith in the battle. None of us know their names, do we? Doesn't give one of their names. But their example of faith is pretty important as well. We'll get into next week looking at what was God's response to all of this. How does this end up playing out? Thank you all so much. We'll be dismissed and rejoin for our devotional in just a minute.